Okay, very good evening, everyone. Welcome to my talk on behind the scenes of 10 C# language features. And I'm actually extremely pleased to see so many people this late on the day sort of volunteering to get their brains blown apart by the internals of the C# compiler. So that's the thing I'm going to do today. I'm going to look behind the scenes of a number of features that are seemingly innocent looking. Like, why is it doing something different behind the scenes than you might expect? So that's basically the theme of this talk. So a big warning up front, I'm just back from Belgium, where some people have tweeted about my talk that it should have a level 666. So, you know, I think there is some you know, division by three happening there. I don't know why they chose that number, but it sounds funny. So the big idea is I just have one slide. It's an a la carte menu. Excuse me for the French, but that's not really a problem here. You know, in Belgium, that would be politically incorrect nowadays. So Belgium, oh, that's that microscopic unit, that little particle of dust, you know, somewhere at the southern border. So basically, based on essential mathematics, you will see that this thing contains 12 features as opposed to 10. The idea is that I can pick anything in here, so and we will do it in a random order based on what people want to see. So that means that two features I might not get to. If we get in some rabbit hole of one feature, it might be the case that I spend like 20 minutes on one feature and maybe just 2 minutes on another feature. So any volunteers to say what they want to see? Async CTP. And somebody has something else? I can start with the expression trees. Dynamic. And we'll have the whole list in just a second if you continue like this. one more, maybe? What? Lambdas, iterators, okay. Let's actually pick something that will become useful for the other features, because those are a little bit dependent on each other. So what about starting with lambdas? Can everyone agree with that? Okay, good. So as promised, this thing doesn't contain any other slides, so our only friend will be Visual Studio. And in fact, I need to warn you, if you have an allergy for ILDASM, please leave the room right now. That's our second friend. We're going to take a look at the IL code generated for every piece of C#. So you might need to put your glasses on and look in a different way. So let's open the DevDays project. I just have some code snippets in there that I prepared some while ago. And let's search for the class, the static class on Lambda. Whoops, I think I say closure. Okay, good. So the thing I want to talk about with regards to Lambda expressions, first let's actually situate what they are. Lambda expressions are a shorthand syntax to declare either a delegate with an anonymous method being generated or an expression tree. And the feature that actually describes the fact that a Lambda can be converted to either of the two is called homoiconicity, meaning that you can take a Lambda expression without any change. When you assign it to a func delegate or an action delegate or any delegate, it generates IL code. If you assign it to an expression of a func or an action or any delegate, it basically creates an expression tree. We'll actually focus now on Lambda expressions that are generating code, that are generating an anonymous method. So that's what I have here. I have some Lambda expressions sitting here that I just am adding to a tuple. So I have a tuple of both a func of int and an action of int. And the first one, the func of int, which basically returns an int, does nothing goes to x, okay? So that's basically something that will return the value of x. The second one is an action of int that will basically execute an assignment to x based on a given y. And I could also put curly braces around x equals y and insert a semicolon, that would be the same. But since there is an implicit conversion of, you know, the expression of an assignment to void, I can leave out the curly braces. So those are really the two things I wanna do here. Now, who knows what the catch is? In this particular case, there is something mysterious happening that if you reason in a stack-oriented fashion, in, you know, a classic, you know, C-style-oriented thing where you say, like, there needs to be a call stack, and this is like a function pointer, there's something weird going on. Who can tell me what that is? Yep. The use of x, exactly. That x, you know, where does it come from? Well, the x lives actually in the outer scope. X lives over here. So how does the Lambda get access to that X assuming that it can be the case that, you know, this frame of the call stack can be completely gone when we return to the caller. We can say, I will return this function that returns X much higher up. And in fact, that's what I'm doing here. I'm doing get accessors from the demo one method. I do get accessors, and then I invoke this get and set method that I extract out of the tuple. At that point, the stack frame that contains local variable X has already been gone. So something needs to happen behind the scenes. And this thing is called a closure, which is actually named after some fundamental mathematics with regards to functional programming and lambda calculus. They invented the word closure over there in the 30s. So what's going on? The compiler is actually not just generating a method that returns X. It also lifts this local variable into a field, and that's what we call a closure. So let me actually show what's going on here, and then I will point out some catch with this thing, where you have to be very careful about closures. So let's compile this thing, copy the full path, and as promised, our best friend will be ildesm. So one of the takeaways of this talk will be, you know, never to give up looking behind the scenes of what the thing does. Like, this is the ultimate democracy. Actually, there is something weird with this screen, I think. Or is that readable? Maybe for me it's not readable. It's not readable. I need a technician to make this thing readable.
Make it your native resolution.
Native resolution? I need to switch resolutions. Can I do that, dear video guy? They're staring at me like I've been beamed down from Mars. Okay. I will just change it, you know, if people complain. You know, you were the lucky ones to get to see everything. And the people watching the video might be a little bit upset. So let's go to the native resolution. Excuse me there. No, don't do that. Too late. Ah. So what should I do? I can switch it back, sure. So I can debug. Oh, excuse me, yeah. I don't understand this, you know, I don't understand, you know, this simple stuff. Okay, so I switch it back. I don't know how to debug video issues. I know how to look at ildesm. So anyone a suggestion what I should do with ildesm now? What? Huh?
Use it? Magnifier tool.
Oh, the magnifier tool. Thank you. Oops. See. Tools, zoom it. Will that work as well? It's written by a kernel guy. It ought to be good. Oh, where is it? Control 4. Is that readable now? Oh, much better. Ah, good. What was I looking for? Closures, yes. So we had this little func sitting there that was actually returning X, and we had an action that was using X to assign something to it. The result of actually doing that, creating those two anonymous methods really, didn't result in some anonymous method just defined in the closures type. Instead, what we got is a so-called display class, which basically contains a public field, and it's a public field because it's on a private type, so that's a total fine thing to do. It's just a nested type. So we have a public field here that contains the local variable X that everyone would seem to think that would be allocated on the stack. So now it's allocated on the heap. And alongside that variable X, or that field X, we have the two methods that I actually generated for the action and the func delegates. So I got two methods generated right alongside that field as, you know, instance methods. So that's really the thing that's going on with closures. So what that means is that whenever you leave, you take that function up and you sort of put it somewhere else, you're basically taking a reference to this display class with you that contains the local variable X. So that means that if you assign to that variable to a delegate and then another delegate will read from it, you actually still see the same value because, you know, it's actually sharing the same X. So that's really what's going on with display classes. Now, there is some important catch that I should point out here. And let's now actually, this will be a little bit ugly because now I need to switch all the time. But if we go back here, I have a second demo that actually points out something where you need to be careful about closures. Here's an example. Say that you have something that's called getAction, right? GetAction is something that returns an action, which is a delegate type, and the action is this one. Nothing goes to console write line of X. Same thing is happening, that X was a local variable, it gets hoisted onto the heap. because it can outlive the current stack frame. So people should not be, you know, pointing at memory that's not no longer there. So that's the reason we put it on the heap. Now we're returning that thing, but in this function, or in this method better, we also close over y in another lambda. The other lambda actually says action A is nothing goes to console write line y dot length. And in fact, I'm abandoning that A even here, like I'm not using it anymore. It could be shared with somebody else. So now I have a closure over x, and I have a closure over y. Now what's really happening, what the compiler is doing here, it's sort of taking a little shortcut, and it's saying, well, it's the same body of code that's having two closures. Let's actually combine them together. And that actually helps a lot when you have lambdas that are sort of both peaking at the same state. Like those two lambdas could be both accessing x and y, and then, you know, it's very useful that those two things live alongside their two public fields in the display class. Now, the thing is that because we have one closure here, in fact, this particular one, this particular function, the lifetime of that one will determine the lifetime of those two variables that now live on the heap. That means if you keep this function alive, you're also keeping the 16 megabyte array alive as well. That's potentially a little memory leak here if you're not careful about closures. So there are ways to solve that. You can actually create your own class where you have those fields sitting together with a method. You can just be careful about not capturing multiple variables in the same scope. Let me actually just show you that this is the case. So closures demo 2, let's write that here, closures demo 2, basically calls that method called getAction. It will ultimately invoke the action, and it will measure the amount of memory before and after doing so. And so what's going on is you will see, oops, that's not a good thing. Well, RLDESM is still going. Good, there we go. You will see that the memory has grown with 16 megabytes approximately by simply, you know, calling that particular closure. And so even though I reclaim all the memory over here, we are still keeping that variable x alive or that variable y alive in the closure. So to get rid of that, I will just prove to you that that variable gets reclaimed if I do this. In fact, now I have still this thing y somewhere on the heap, but I will do a collection. If you do gc get total memory with 2, it forces a collection. So you will actually see that the 16 megabytes is gone now, even though in the past the action could also be reclaimed, right? You know, it's an action that nobody's referring to. So this thing is artificially keeping y alive. So that's something you need to be aware of. And so as you can see over here, memory has grown a little bit. I don't know why that is. You know, there might be something else. Well, likely I've allocated an action object. But so you see, like, now I don't have the 16 megabytes leaking out. So that's all about closures. So closures, just very brief recap, is if you have a lambda, or actually an anonymous delegate, just, you know, using the delegate keyword, delegate curly brace something, you close over the outer scope, you actually allocate a closure. That has been the case ever since C Sharp 2.0. Okay, so far for lambdas. Back to the menu. What was the next thing that people would like to hear? Let me try to remember. Some people wanted dynamic. Some people wanted async. And there was somebody talking about iterators, I guess. Maybe we should do something lightweight first, and then we'll do something heavy again. Okay. So let me pick one myself first of all as well. This innocent-looking switch statement, that's actually a piece of beauty. Let's take a look at how that innocent thing actually works. So switch. Switch, you're a bitch. Ha, here we go. So I have a switch here. Actually, I will even not execute it. I will just, you know, go and do RLDESM stuff. So say that I have a switch on x, which is an int. And as we all know, you can only switch on things that can be compile time constants. You can't switch, for example, on an object or a type or something. You need to be a string or an int or some, you know, primitive type. But so I'm switching on 0 and 1. How does this thing get generated behind the scenes? Actually, let's just take a look at that immediately and then raise some more questions just after that. So switch demo 1. What? Zoom. Yeah, I will zoom. Yes, yeah. Here we go. Ooh, wonderful. Oh, this is a little ugly, but, you know. Okay, we'll make it work. So the thing you're seeing here is basically the switch instruction that the CLR has built in is being used. How does the switch instruction work? Given an integer number, all those things here in between parentheses correspond to increasing numbers. If the value of the switch, which is loaded from the local variable slot, which is actually loaded from the argument passed in, happens to be 0, we jump to IL13. If it's 1, we jump to IL20. So I'm extremely lucky that I actually have a switch that does 0 and 1. That's the ideal fit for the CLR. It has a built-in primitive to switch on 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, just as long as you can imagine. So that's beautiful. In case of 13, we switch, or in case of 0, we switch to 13, where we load 0 and we do console write line of 0, and then we branch out of the switch. That's basically the break keyword being emitted here, which brings us all the way back to the return statement, and so we leave the method. So that's good. That's just a switch built into the runtime. Beautiful. However, what's happening with the following piece of code? Actually, I'll try to keep the zoom up here. Say that I do demo 2. Let's see what's the point I'm trying to make here. Actually, this one doesn't matter. Let's skip that one. Let's do demo 3. Demo 3 is a little more tricky. What I'm doing here is I'm switching on different cases, case 11, case 12, case 14. It's not consecutive, and it's not based from 0. Like, how does that work with a switch keyword? How can the CLR switch instruction make this thing work? Well, the answer is, well, we just play a little trick. What will we switch on? We'll switch on x minus 11, and then switch on 0, 1, and we'll have a hole for 13. For 13, we'll just jump out of it. So we'll create a switch table based on the proximity of the numbers by rebasing things. So that's the thing that's going on here. So demo 3 will actually do the following. In demo 3, we see first we'll subtract 11 from the argument coming in, and now we built a little switch table for 11, 12, 13, I didn't have 13, 14, 15, I didn't have 15, I didn't have 16, I did have 17 and 18. The ones I didn't have jumped to, what's the number? 93, and 93 will of course be something that jumps out of the switch block. Let's just go to the end of the method. If you have even more sparse things, you might actually see even more exciting things. You might see switches and switches based on, you know, arithmetic that brings us to the closest and smallest switch blocks that we can actually find. So don't be amazed if you look at the switch. I told you it's a little bit of a bitch. So, and you see some other, you know, interesting things here, which I won't elaborate on, but you see, like, here are the things we actually jump to. Print 11, print 12, print 13, and so on. And 93 is the return, which is used for things like 13, which are missing from my switch table. So we just jump to the end. Okay, but there is more. I told you that switch is so exciting. Memory penalty for the gaps? Yes, yeah, the switch table is part of the instruction stream, and so it needs to be bigger to have labels to the things that are missing. So, you know, if the gaps are very big, you might see lots of small switches. If they're, you know, if the gaps are relatively small compared to the number of cases, we'll just insert some gaps. Just depends on, you know, what we wanna, how we feel that day. Now, here's another one. The switch instruction in the CLR can only work on integers. How do we do it for strings? Huh, that's an interesting one. Say that I switch on bar and foo and quirks and some other things. How do we do a switch on that? Well, the answer is we simply emit if, else, if, else, if, else, if. That kind of code. Except in one case. So, it gets really exciting. So here what we do is, as you can see, I will explain this code. This is really something that just does if, else, if, else. What you see is we load the local variable 0, which is the input to the switch. We load bar, then we do an op equality check that's at the end of this line. And we basically see whether it's equal. In case it's equal, we branch to some particular location that will do the appropriate piece of code that was in the case block. So we basically branch to 2F, and that will be the thing that prints bar onto the screen. So that's just an if, else if, else if, else if. Now say that you have a huge amount of cases, like say 100 cases for strings. Do you really want to compare everything to everything to find the 99th to be the right one? That would be kind of sad that you hit the least optimal case and we need to do a lot of comparisons to find your case. So in fact, if you have more than 7, well, 7 including, more than 6 that means, cases, we actually do something slightly different. If you have more than 6, As you can see over here, bar, foo, quirks, bus, for, bus, and knob. In that case, yeah, they all need to be three letters, otherwise I can't sleep. So we have those seven things here. Huh, what do we do in that case? In that case, we say, let's actually allocate a dictionary that maps a string onto an int. Now we have a switch table using a dictionary so that we can basically do a try get value on the dictionary. If it comes back with an int, we can switch on the int to go to the appropriate block. So we basically generate a dictionary for you, which is lazily evaluated. In fact, this thing is not computed until the first time you hit that code. There's a branch false instruction here that says if this thing is null, then we're basically going to new up the dictionary and then continue. If it's not null, we keep it there. So that's basically what's going on. Where does that dictionary live? The dictionary actually lives in the private implementation details, which is a generated type for your assembly, and there you will find the generic dictionary sitting that actually contains your switch block in case you've hit the code. So that's what we do. Okay, so I told you switch is exciting, but I can't make it more exciting than this. So I don't know where my slides are. Well, this is not good, but back to the menu. Oops. So we've had two things already. My clock isn't working, like it's still at 75 minutes here, so I will just keep going. Now let's do a customer request. Somebody wanted to talk about expression trees? Yep. So let's talk a little bit about expression trees because that's very closely related to lambdas. So what are expression trees? Basically, they're a code representation of a data representation, better of code, so that at runtime you can take a look at them, for example, to translate link query into T-SQL or Amazon queries or whatever. So that's actually why they were invented. Later they were also used for the DLR, the dynamic language runtime. So how do expression trees work? Let's see. Expressions, okay, here we go. So what I have here is a very simple expression tree. So you will notice that when you use a lambda, you can't use the var keyword. You can't infer the type for a lambda expression simply because it can either be assigned to an expression tree or a func. We can't make up our mind. So you have to tell us what the type needs to be. So if I do something like assigning this thing to a func of int, comma int, it would generate an anonymous method. If I assign it to an expression, we generate an expression tree. Now, how does that code look behind the scenes? I could show you that, but I will just type it here. And assume that I don't have the debug part. Basically, the expression tree generated here would be the following code. We would first have a parameter expression, p, which will be, not like this, expression.parameter. We'll call that thing x, and we'll do a type of int. So we'll say, I need to have a parameter. And then, you know, the expression twice will be expression of func, this thing, twice equals expression, expression dot lambda. It's all factory methods of func of int goes to int. And now I need to basically pass in the body of the lambda expression, which is the code that executes as part of the, the body. So that will be expression of, that p times 2. So really it ends up something like this, expression dot multiply of expression, we already have the parameter, which is x, that's p, comma, expression of constant of 2. So that's the code that the compiler actually generates for that little line of code that I have sitting here. It gets a little more complicated if you have method calls and indexers and properties and all of that stuff. We have expression tree nodes for all of those. So that's actually what's going on here with regards to the translation, and you can actually see exactly that code in ILDASM, but this thing is quite long to take a look at. When I actually had this code here, I wanted to show you one powerful capability that you might know of, that given an expression tree, you can actually dot compile it. And if you dot compile an expression tree, we generate using LCG, lightweight code gen, the IL equivalent of the lambda expression. And that can be invoked. So that's what I'm doing here. I'm compiling it. Now I get a func from int to int. I pass in 3, and then ultimately this thing will return 6. Now, the thing I want to show you is that, in fact, code gets generated for this, which will look a lot like a mul instruction for x and 2. I just want to prove that point here. So I use debug so that I can sort of hit a breakpoint while that expression is executing. So let's actually take a look at that. Let me first put my demo here, expressions.demo1. Okay. Let's go to the definition. Okay, there we go. Whoops. RLDESM is still there. Okay, good. F5. We'll hit the breakpoint. This is not very readable this way, but you know, we hit the breakpoint in debug, and below on the call stack is some external code that when we do show the code, you get to see that it's a lightweight function, which is basically generated at runtime. So we have essentially the IL equivalent of the original Lambda expression now running at runtime. And so we have a runtime compiler that takes those expression trees into IL code, which is also used by the dynamic language runtime. If you really want to go crazy, you can even visualize the IL code being generated. Do we want to be that crazy? Oh, I like this audience. That's what I do at night, so you know. So in order to visualize the IL code, I will load the son of strike, SOS. That's a debugger extension that's actually written for WinDebug, but it happens that Visual Studio can load it. How do you load it in Visual Studio? The answer is as follows. Let me actually break out of here, do Control 4 to zoom out. You need to be sure that you enable unmanaged code debugging on the debug tab of your project. Otherwise, SOS refuses to load in the immediate window. Now, as soon as you do that, you can load the debugger extension. So you can say here, load C, Windows, Microsoft.NET, framework, V4030319, SOS.dll. Those numbers you should rehearse, you know, like the first thing. The first thing you do in a bar is like, what was the version of, you know, .NET 2 OCLR? Oh, 50727, yeah. Like, you know, that's the thing you should do. Now, I have that. I have the extension sitting here now. I can invoke SOS commands using the bang syntax. So if I do bang help here, you see all the beautiful things you can ask SOS, which Visual Studio is not capable, I should say, of giving you because, you know, it's kind of an advanced thing. So you can search the GC heap, you know, like look what's on the GC near some location, all of that nice stuff. So the thing I'm going to do here is I'm doing CLR stack. CLR stack is just a command in SOS to dump the stack. You might see some errors for iDebug client. That means the extension is trying to talk back to Visual Studio, and Visual Studio says, I only implement the things that are barely needed for this thing to work. So they don't implement the entire interface. WinDebug actually does. So in WinDebug, you wouldn't see those errors, but in general, you can basically ignore them. So I will ignore them. Now, if you take a look here, you see that there is something called dynamic class.lambda underscore method, which sits on my call stack between demo1 and debug. Debug is the thing executed as part of my Lambda expression, because I had debug of x in there, or x times 2. And then you see, you know, the Lambda, that's actually the generated code, which was invoked by, you know, dot compile and then calling the thing given a tree. So what I'm interested in is the instruction pointer of this guy, which is in this column. I just take that thing, and now you can do bang u. And bang u, it looks a little dramatic here because of the interface thingies, but bang u essentially does the unassemble of the method. And the unassemble of the method should give you the times 2 thing somewhere. Here it is. Times 2 is implemented as an addition of the thing with itself. Adding two things together is the same as multiplying them by 2, right? So that's actually the code generated for x times 2 in my expression tree. Later you see that here we are actually setting up a call to the debug method in which we are living, and that's indicated by the three larger than signs over here. That's our current location in the execution. So all the information is there. You can even do a dash u on anything you want to see what the JIT compiler generates. Basically, you can issue a command. I won't go there because that would be a crash course of SOS. You can do name2ee, which is given the name of a method, fully specified, including namespaces, assemblies, the whole thing. You can get to an address, and that address you can actually give to bang u, and then you see the IL generated for that method. And you might, for example, see that your property get methods simply do not exist because they got inlined. So BangU is actually a pretty useful thing to take a look at how good the JIT compiler is about doing things. I would also encourage you to do name2ee on, for example, mat.cosine and mat.sine to see that, how surprising, Intel processors and AMD processors have a built-in instruction for sine and cosine. The JIT compiler knows that and turns those things into an efficient instruction. So name2ee, just go crazy, disassemble the entire framework. I don't care. That's not on video. Good. Is that what I want to talk about with expression trees? Yes. There's much more to be told because the expression tree syntax or the expression tree API supports all sorts of expressions, so it's quite a rich API and we could easily talk about it for a whole day. Now, what's next? Some people screamed out dynamic and the DLR. Some people screamed out iterators. Those two I definitely want to get to. Iterators get to async CTP pretty quickly. I want to sneak in something over here, which is also a little surprising. Read-only arrays, and then we'll take a look at iterators. Okay? So read-only arrays are one of those things that look innocent, but are beautiful. So let's have a look. Shift F5. Arrays. Here we go. What happens if you do this? What happens if you allocate an array, static read-only, and use it? And I don't care about the using part, you know, that just works. Not unexpected that it works, of course, but, you know. How does that array get initialized? Some people might say, well, we generate a static constructor that then loads 2, loads 3, loads 5, 7, and 11 on the stack, and then shoves them into the array that's allocated on the heap using a store lm instruction. The answer is false. That's not the way it happens, because we don't want to waste time if you, for example, have a huge array sitting here with a million things in it, for example, for some shader function or whatever, some, you know, numeric manipulation. You might have a huge array. We already know the elements of the array. There is no dynamism associated with the values of the array because they're always the same. Why can't we just store those as part of the executable file and just map them into memory? So that's actually the thing that happens for this thing. So let me actually go to a pretty nice exercise here, trying to find the array in the bytes of my executable. Okay, I'm masochistic, but, you know, let's do it. So Windows 4, Alt-4, Alt-4, Alt-4. Whoops, no, Control-4. Yep, there we go. Arrays. So here you see a static init-only int32 array. That's the guy we're talking about. How does it get initialized? Well, you might say it's in the static constructor. In fact, there is some code in the static constructor here that helps us doing this job. So this is what happens in the static constructor. The static constructor says, I'm going to take a look at some field in this private implementation details wacky type that gets generated by the compiler. So what's going on in there is, of course, the question. We're just going to look at that thing, apparently. We're just getting, you know, access to that field. Then we're passing the field to a runtime helper called compilerservices.runtimehelpers initialize array given that particular field. There's some magic going on here already. Ignore that function. I'm interested in that field. What's that field? How magic is it? The answer is it's not that magic. So let's take a look. The field lives in here in the private implementation details. And we see there is a static array init type size of 20 sitting here. 20 is 5 times 4, which is the size of an int32, 4 bytes. So this already knows how long the range should be in the executable assembly or the binary to find the array. We still need to know where to look in the executable, where the compiler has sort of stored all the, you know, values of your array. So where is that information? Well, the answer is it's sitting over here. I'm not sure I can actually scroll to that easily. Bear with me for a second. How do I get to the end of that? Oh. Mark Rusinovich, you're great. Good. So there we go. What you see over here is there is a static init type size of 20, which is allocated at some weird number. What's that weird number? That's a relative offset relative to the base address where the image gets loaded in memory for the executable. So given that number, memorize the number 32358, we can actually find the array in the executable file. Let's do that. 2358. So here we go. oops, like this. Dump bin slash all of dev days, whoops, of, oh, that whole thing. Dump bin slash all of that whole thing, pipe to more. This dumps the executable contents. That's a tool that comes from the C++ toolkit for a long time. It's in the Windows SDK. You will find it in your Visual Studio command prompt if you have installed enough. You see that the executable is a 32-bit executable, for example. It runs on an x86 machine, blah, blah, blah. It was generated at a certain time. Lots of interesting stuff in here. What we're interested in is in the base address where the image gets loaded in memory. That thing says 400,000. Okay, so 400,000 plus 2358 will be the place where our array lives. There, magic. Let's take a look. We're now dumping the contents of the assembly. And what was the number again? I forgot. 2358. 2358. 2358. Somewhere. 2358. 2358. 2358. 2. 3, 5, 7, B, that's 11. So there's your array, just loaded in memory. No code needs to execute to get to your data. It's just sitting in your assembly. Good? We need to store it anyway. So why would we waste some execution time to populate the array? Good. So, back here, next thing on the menu, there's not much more to be said about arrays. What did I promise? Did I promise dynamic or iterators? Iterators, right? First, iterators. Iterators are the most complicated piece of code in the C# compiler, other than async and await, which essentially uses exactly the same logic. So both of those are the most complicated thing. So what are iterators? Very briefly, I assume everyone knows, but let's take a look here. Iterators. Here we go. A very simple iterator. I don't even want to go into a difficult one because then we're here till tomorrow. So this iterator simply yield returns out two values, 42 and 83. Now what's an iterator do? Whenever you do move next on this thing, it runs till the next yield return statement. And then it pauses execution of the entire method. Now how does that work? It works by having again a heap allocated object. That's basically the implementation of IEnumerable of T. And then in there, we build a state machine. A state machine that says, you know, where the instruction in the iterator currently is and what the next piece of code is to execute when the user does move next from that point on. So the first time, the state machine will be at something like zero. In fact, it starts negative, but let's ignore that part. Say the state machine is at zero. The compiler says, over here, the state machine is at zero. Then we'll switch on the current state, which is zero. And then we'll start executing all the code up to the yield return. And then we increment the state to, for example, 2, so that the next time you call move next, we start with 2, we go in that switch block, we say from state 2, which is like a private instruction pointer, we start executing the next piece of code. So essentially what the compiler does is basic block analysis. It says, everywhere there is a yield return, I'm just drawing a line. And all of those basic blocks need to have their unique number in a switch table to know where we were before we yielded something out. So looking at that code, in fact, the code that I'm going to show you is not the code you will see when you look at the C# 4.0 compiler, because I've installed the async CTP and they've messed a little bit with the generated code, for better or worse. And actually, it's for better. But so let's take a look. Alt-4, no, Control-4. We go to iterators. And here you already see that we generated some private type. By the way the type names are generated is always by having syntactical tokens in there you cannot refer to from C#. So it always starts with a lowercase or a less than, I mean, a less than symbol, because less than is not a valid token for a type name in C#. So, you know, that's basically a little story there. Also, the letters that are used, don't rely on this, by the way. The letters used, like D and F, indicate the kind of compiler-generated code. So, for example, for an iterator, it will be D. For an anonymous type, it will be F. For a lambda expression, it will be something else. I forgot. So, that's the iterator. That's that innocent two yield returns compiled. So just briefly walking over that, it's an implementation of IEnumerable of T. So no surprise you will see a getEnumerator method and a generic one, all of that stuff. In fact, it also implements IEnumerator of T as well on the same object. It basically maps those two things together using a very nifty trick in the getEnumerator code that says if there are multiple parties executing this thing, then only we need to instantiate multiple objects. But the default case is that you have an iterator and there's a single consumer, then basically having an IEnumerable and an IEnumerator implemented by the same type is much more cheap than having two objects. It's only when you start iterating multiple times we start creating additional enumerator objects. So that's a little thing. If you look at getEnumerator over here, you will actually see some interesting code that does something with the managed strat ID even to figure out what's going on. We'll ignore that part. Let's look at the fields. The fields contain a number of things. Ignore the initial thread ID. That's for the trick I've just sort of alluded at. There is also a disposing thing that sort of keeps track of whether the user is disposing, so that we can throw disposed exceptions and whatnot, or avoid doing some work. But those are the two important things, the state and the current. The state is that state machine thing, where every time we do yield return, we increment that thing so that the next time the user does a move next, we know where to resume the execution of the method. So that's basically a little thing that we switch on. And then the current thing is basically just the backing field for the getCurrent method of the current property, which lives here at the bottom of the slide or of the screen. So all the magic happens in move next. I'm not going to walk through this thing completely because that's kind of interesting. But essentially what's going on here, it's not even scrolling very nicely, is we're loading the state parameter, which is our current place in the iterator where we're executing. We'll take that, we'll switch on it. We even do some little subtraction here because it's based on a different value. It actually starts with -1 for some reason we won't go into. It's not an optimized build, so I see some void branch instructions here. For example, there is a branch setting from 1F to 21. If you would compile the /O+, you would actually see those branch instructions gone because we know we shouldn't jump twice in a row. We can just jump to the target value. But the optimizer wasn't executed on the code, so we actually have that stuff sitting here. Ultimately, we do some stuff with the state over here, for example. We compare the state to -1. In that case, we start some magic voodoo to start executing the thing. Otherwise, you know, we start jumping into the switch table to the point where we execute pieces of code. So, for example, there will be some state, the state to go to the first yield return that ends up, I think, over here on 4D. And that thing actually computes value 42, stores it in the current field so that somebody who does get current on it sees 42 coming out, because that's what an iterator does, right? You do move next and then you do get current in the for each loop to get the value out. And then ultimately in here, from 42, it goes on to getting to the state value, and it's actually going to change the state value somewhere. It's going to store value 1 in the state. So the state gets incremented to know that we're at the next instruction in the iterator. So it basically keeps track of where you are executing in the iterator code. So that's what's going on there. And then ultimately, we end with a leave instruction. The leave instruction is the only way that you can exit a protected block, a try-catch block, in the CLR. That actually helps the CLR to know where things happen. So, you know, we end with a leave instruction, we just get out of that entire method, and then, you know, the user can call move next again. The next time the state will be at 1, we'll switch to a different location in this code, which will load 83. And 83 will then be yielded out. That code sits somewhere over here. That's this one. Ultimately, the state will go into a value of 2, which in this case is the last state of the iterator, and at that point, move next will start returning false, saying there are no further values. So that's actually the whole state machine being built here. It's much more tricky than that, because you could yield return and try catch finally statements and all of that stuff, and we need to suppress executing finallys in case you're still running the iterator. Like, there's lots of stuff happening there as well. In fact, you can see evidence of that. There is a Boolean that says, should we or shouldn't we execute finally bodies as part of this move next call? Because the move next call can have multiple yield returns. We only want to do the finally after you really jump out of that try catch block. So there are some interesting state maintenance things going on here. In fact, the do finally bodies, I believe, was introduced for the await feature. That name you won't find in a C# 4.0 compiled project with an iterator. It will have some different name. There's some cleanup being done there because async await and iterators really build the same state machine. So we reuse exactly the same code for both of them, which is pretty interesting. So, which means actually the await feature is a relatively cheap feature for the compiler team. Maybe not for the debugger team, but that's somebody else's problem. Okay, so that were iterators. We should really have like some marker over here that we can rule out things that we've already seen. So what have we seen? We have seen switch, we've seen read-only arrays, lambdas and closures, iterators. We have some little things over here. You want to talk about dynamics still, so first let's do a simple feature, right? Something rather simple like, say, anonymous types. I promise you that's a really simple one. So how do anonymous types get generated? Then we get into dynamic, and then we look at async, okay? So anonymous types introduced in C# 3.0 for link basically are a short way to new up some type, right? So here we go. Here's two anonymous types, name and age, two properties, initialized with Bart and 28, John and 64, or 62 better. And we call some methods on that guy, like equals get hash code and toString. And we actually see that those things return meaningful values. Like if you have two of those things, that would be bar 28, the equals method would return true. So even though they are anonymous types and generated, the compiler sort of merges them together for things that look the same. Now there are some catches to that. The order matters. An anonymous type is basically a tuple of name value pairs. So if you would have an anonymous type name, age, and an anonymous type age, name, they would never be equal. They would always return false to the equals method. It's only when they have the same shape, really, that the two things are considered equalable, if that's the right word. If not, now it is. So we have equals, get hash code, and toString. ToString basically prints exactly this syntax. It will print something like curly brace name equals the toString method of this and the toString method of that. Yeah, question? No, no. If you add an additional member to the type, you have a different type altogether. So there's no such thing as structural equivalence, which you have in certain type systems, where a 0.2D would be a 0.3D, because a 0.3D has just one more member than a 2D point. So there's no such typing relationship in C# or the CLR. So that's the reason that's not the case. So only when there is the same number of members with the same types in the same order, they can be considered equal. That's the basic idea. And that's basically what you do if you have, like, say, for example, a hash set that contains all those guys. Well, in that case, equality makes a lot of sense to have. And then, you know, your hash set would have to have the same element type, which you would have to infer somehow because it's an anonymous type, but that's a different story. So let's take a look at the generated stuff for this. It's actually not much. Well, in IL it always looks a lot, but, you know, it's not that bad. So for the anonymous types, we generate the anonymous types sitting over here. If you go to Eric Lippert's blog, you will get an entire explanation of why anonymous types are generated as generic types. That's a long story. I won't tell it over here, but you can find it. But so anonymous types are generated as generic types that are parameterized in the two or any number of properties that actually live on the anonymous type. So you see that we have an age field, we have a name field, which are init only. So those things are read-only, meaning that you cannot assign to name and age properties once you have created the object. So they're immutable data structures. In VB, you can actually say that you want a mutable one or an immutable one, and you can even do a little bit more in VB by specifying a uniqueness key. So you can say, like, this particular property of the anonymous type has to be the key. And that's the one used for equality. C# doesn't have that facility. You might want to take a look at the difference there. But so we generate code for equals, get hash code and toString, and then just some properties. The properties are trivial. They just return out the field. So the code for equals, not big surprise. It's basically just going to do some type checks. to see that you're comparing the current guy to somebody of the same type. So that's what's happening here. The isInst instruction is basically the closest approximation to the as keyword in C sharp. The as keyword in C sharp, when you do something like an object as string, emits an isInst instruction that basically pushes something of the target type onto the evaluation stack. In case it doesn't match the type, you get a null. So you can actually always do a branch false instruction after that to basically say, in case it's null, we do something else. You will actually see branch false being used to do null checks. That's the way null checks actually work. So in this case, if the two things are the same, we don't branch to 3A, which is in case they are not the same, because then the isInst returns null, just like the as keyword would return null. In that case, we start doing some stuff, and what I wanted to point out here is that equality for anonymous types is based on calling into equality compare of the field type dot default dot compare or dot equals. So we actually go to system collections generic equality compare of t to do that stuff. So that's something you might be interested in knowing, like how that code actually gets, for example, when you step into an equals method on an anonymous type, why that code ends up in a certain equality implementation of yours and what the call stack looks like. Because it goes to the equality compare, it might dispatch to your virtual equals override of your underlying type. So it makes sense to sort of know the path that the compiler takes to get there. So that's what we have here. You see two equality compares, one for the name field, one for the age field, which happen to be built-in types, so there's no voodoo happening here. So that's really what the equals method does in a nutshell. Not that much to it. The getHashCode one is interesting because we know a little bit about generating good hash codes. So you see some big numbers here that are used to blend together with, you know, the hash codes of the fields. Those are some awfully large prime numbers normally. But other than that, we basically again go into the equality compare for the fields. And on the equality compare, we say get hash code for this field, get hash code for the other field. We do it for all the fields. Then we mumble them together using some bit shifts and some prime numbers. And then we get a hash code that's unique enough to be considered for that particular type. So there's some pretty good number generator in the C-sharp compiler as well to generate those wacky numbers. In fact, those might actually be just statically allocated and always be the same. But so that's what's going on here. Get hash code, not that much as well. ToString, the ToString method generates the string that's used to display the anonymous type. The way that thing does it, as everything should do it with regards to building something that you don't know the size of up front, it actually uses a string builder to be as efficient as possible. So it says, I'm allocating a string builder, I'm first loading the string curly brace name equals, and then I do a toString on the name field. I concatenate that. Then you will find some code on line 25 that concatenates comma spacebar h equals something. Then we do the h toString, and ultimately we'll also do the string builder, append the closing curly brace somewhere on line 43. And ultimately that whole thing is done toString, so we end up with a string and we return that thing out. So that's all the stuff that's happening. As you can see, string builders are pure goodness. So they actually are. Actually, there's an interesting box instruction here. Oh yeah, string builder takes in some... Now I'm curious. Oh yeah, it's appending an object. And appending an object, of course, because you assign an int to an object, it needs to be boxed. Makes sense. So that's what's happening there. Good. So with that, we can go into some exciting stuff. I promised you dynamic. Still have 12 minutes. I know it's grueling, another 12 minutes of IL code. And then we'll go into async await. So dynamic is based on those expression trees, as you might know. Dynamic languages actually generate, using the system.link.expressions API, they generate their whole trees of, you know, the code, and then they do dot compile on it to basically get an efficient piece of code executing at runtime. Now, what I want to show you is not how a dynamic language generates its code by means of using expression trees. What I want to show you is how the call-side cache works of the DLR. So what's the call-side cache? Just briefly. Say that you have a calculator type coming from Python. And the calculator type takes in two objects, A and B. and doesn't plus between the two. It's totally dynamically typed, so you can give any A and any B. You can give two ints, and then it will return an int. You can give it two strings, it will return the concatenated string. If you give it a date time and a time span, Python will be happy because it knows how to add those two things together because there's an operator overload. Now, the thing is that whenever you do that, say, for example, the first time you face Iron Python with a date time and a time span, it needs to look for some method, the operator that's used to add those two things together. Now, that lookup takes some time. It needs to do reflection stuff and all of that magic to find the right overload. Now, once it knows that, it might be the case that you call the same calculator addition method a million times using datetime and time span. In that case, we do not want to generate again the same, you know, code for that particular call, because we already know if you have a datetime and a time span, that's the method to use to add the two things together. So we can basically start optimizing the code. The more dynamic calls you make, the faster it goes. And it gets specialized with kind of type checks. The code that gets generated is something like, if A is an int and B is an int, then do this. Next time you execute a code, you give it a datetime and a time span. Basically, it adds dynamically at runtime some code that says, if A is a datetime and B is a time span, do this piece of code. So it basically starts creating a switching table based on the combinations of all those, you know, input arguments to the dynamic method call. So it gets very efficient very quickly, which is a good thing. That's an inline polymorphic cache. That's another name for that. So let's take a look at dynamic. I'm not doing it with Python. I'm just doing it with a calc type that I have sitting here. So dynamic demo 1 will just show you that through the magic of dynamic, we ultimately end up in this piece of code, which is what we should, of course, end up with. Now, you could also do this thing statically, so don't try this at home. This is bad code. You shouldn't do a dynamic call to something of which you statically know the type. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. We should actually have a warning for that. Well, not really, but, you know, we could. But so, if you would use the var keyword here, we all know it would be statically typed. If you use dynamic, it's dynamically typed. So the add method call becomes a dynamic lookup. So executing this code will bring us to the add method. That's a pretty good thing. I'm using an instance method here just because, well, I want to do virtual dispatch to an instance method. For a static method, there would be no fun and giggles here because static methods are always known at compile time. So dynamic.demo1. Dynamic.demo1 ultimately brings us to return A plus B. Higher up the call stack, we are actually sitting here. I don't get highlighting for that for some reason. But if you look at the code here, you see a number of things. As expected, you see the lightweight function that's generated to basically dispatch into the add method. That's some DLR magic. There's something else sitting on the call stack that I want to take a look at with you. That's this thing. I will not go into all the details of it, but there is some magic thing sitting there called update and execute 3, given an object, an int, and an object. That's some kind of voodoo that's happening in the DLR to optimize the call site. Now, how does that work? Pretty interesting, as usual. Demo 2 has the code that gets generated for the demo 1 method. So that's what you will find in IL for that little line of code higher up. So this piece of code over here, actually this middle line over here, turns into something that looks more or less like this. In fact, those objects are even allocated in static fields so that we don't have to reallocate them all the time. So there are some additional optimizations. What's going on here? What's being generated? The first thing is something that comes from the magic Microsoft.C#.dll assembly. Those are runtime helpers that basically describe the thing that the user did. So that's the whole point of dynamic, right? In dynamic, you say something that the compiler can't figure out yet at compile time. You say, I have a calculator, I do an add method on it, but it can't find it because it doesn't have type info. So it needs to build up, you know, all the knowledge of the compiler at runtime, so that at runtime we can search for an add method just based on the reflection type, the dynamic type, or the DLR type. So that's what's going on here. We create a so-called binder that's doing invoke member. That's because we did calc.add. That's an invoke member case. And we pass in some binding flags. We say, you know, what the user actually wanted to do. Let's just show you the binding flags to get a sense of what the information is that's communicated to the runtime. So there you see things like, are you in a checked context? If you have checked keywords around you, then this flag will be turned on, so that we know at runtime that we need to generate code that basically does overflow checking. You have lots of other things here. For example, result discarded is when you call a method that returns a value, but you basically don't assign it, so you treat it as void. That information is useful to do lookups at runtime. So we actually capture all of that stuff around over here. So a lot of little things. In this case, there are no flags being used. There are some other things being passed in. Some type info. There is, in this case, the context type. So we say like where this call happens. We remember like the add call happens in a type called dynamic, which means if we reach into some dynamic type, we find out that the calculator type lives in some other assembly somewhere where we shouldn't have access to because of visibility constraints, we can bail at you and say like, you shouldn't be able to do that because you're violating public or private here. So we capture this whole add method. So at runtime, we can find it now. We can basically say, well, you know, look for an add method based on arguments 2 and 3. So we can do that. You can do that yourself as well by doing .get type and get all the methods and then find a method that matches. That's basically the voodoo that's happening. It's pretty complicated with overload resolution, but that's basically all the information needed. Now, the magic part sits in the middle. There is something called a call site. In reality, that thing actually lives in a static field. Let's ignore that for now. But what happens here is this. The call site is the container of the dynamically generated efficient code to do the dynamic call. So if you blast through this thing the first time using two ints, the call site learns that you've gone through that call site using two ints, and it adds some code to itself, saying like, if the two things are ints, then I already know how to do it. So it basically creates that big, you know, switch table based on the types of the input parameters. If I would bust through the same code using calc with time span and datetime, it would generate some different code added to the call site. And so the way that works is as follows. The call site has some delegate on it called target that basically gets a reference to itself and then gets all the parameters to the call. And in there, it basically sees, do I already know this case? Do I already know what to do with two ints? If not, I'm going to learn. Like, it's just, you know, swallowing additional knowledge. It's doing the resolution. It finds out, oh, to add two ints, I need to do this instruction. And then it adds it to itself. And this way, basically, this cache gets updated all the time with very efficient code based on all the inputs that you actually go through. The same thing happens for the second dynamic call site in this piece of code. The second dynamic call site is this one. Calc.add of 2 and 3 is assigned to int. That's an implicit conversion. Because if you would really write this dynamically, you would say dynamic x equals call calc.add of 2 and 3. If you assign it to an int, there is a dynamic call to figure out how to convert this thing to an int. So that's a second call site being built up there. So if the first time calc.add returns an int, the call site will learn how to convert an int to an int, which is not doing anything. If the second time you call calc of add with datetime and time span, and you try to assign it to an int, the call site will learn how to throw an exception in that case. So that the next time you try that, it will always throw an exception at you, saying those two things are not compatible. We only need to learn that thing once to do it, right? It's knowledge that you should just figure out one time. You could actually, again, visualize the code generated for this. I might have a blog post on that. In fact, I've also written a book on C#, C# 4.0 Unleashed. Oh, little publication here. It has a sidebar that shows how to visualize the entire dynamic call sites. So you can actually see that there is really some if instruction. If it's an int and an int, do this. If it's this and that, do that. You know, that all of that stuff basically is described in there. It's basically, you use SOS, you do some voodoo in there, you get to see all the IL code generated. So with that, I think we actually got most of the a la carte menu. We still have the async await stuff. I think we got almost 10 of them. That's a pretty good total. So the async CTP await. Now I need to explain what await does. How many of you have seen await already? Okay. Good. Let's see. So the await feature, just in a nutshell, is this piece of code here. Just look at this piece of code. A new web task, that's trivial. It simply returns 42. A real task would take a long time to compute, for example, the value of pi, very useful knowledge to compile or to compute. But you could have a long-running operation. You could have a network call that exposes its result as a task of something, a task of a byte array, for example, coming back from the network. The way you used to write code in the past to basically chain actions together, like when the asynchronous callback completes, I need to do this. The way you would write that code would be very ugly and inside out. You might want to use event handlers. You might need to use async callbacks. You might need to use continue with on task of T. There are a lot of ways to do that. There's no unification in how you do asynchrony. In fact, I have a talk about the asynchronous landscape tomorrow, where we'll go into in much more detail. But so in the past, for this piece of code, you would have to write something like this. T.continue with of T underbar goes to console.writeline of T underbar.result instead of writing this. So your code all starts to look indented because the thing that happens after the asynchronous callback completes now needs to be in the lambda expression. And then you might do something else that's async and it doesn't blend nicely with control flow. Like, can you put a try-catch around this whole thing? Not really. You will only have a try-catch around start new and continue with, but not a try-catch around the inner lambda. So you will have to do all that magic stuff. With C-sharp 5.0, or you know, the next version, we haven't committed to a particular version number yet, but you know, in the next version, one of the next versions of C-sharp, you will have the capability of writing this, which means the same as the original code. You can now await an object that supports asynchrony, and then you can just start writing imperative-style code. You can just, you know, get the X here, which will be of type int, and continue writing code. And you can do try-catches around that and while loops and all of that stuff. Now, it just so happens that the compiler transformation that's done for this is exactly the same as the compiler transformation for yield return. Basically, upon every await, this method sort of needs to be suspended. Like, the await means some asynchronous operation is going, and the rest of the code needs to execute when the asynchronous operation completes. So I need to remember where I was, and the next time I enter this method, because the network says, hey, here's the byte array, it needs to say, oh, I left off just at the await of T over here, now I need to execute the next piece of code. And maybe I will hit another await of T, or an await of something else, and then I will suspend again, remember where I was, like a little script monk that's copying books, like he remembers I was on page 42. He knows that the next time, you know, a callback comes, we jump to that location and continue executing. And so, essentially, the way that that gets translated more or less is like this. So the await of T gets translated into code that looks like this. As you can see, the piece of code that executes after the await, that's this part, together with this part, actually gets lifted into an action, a callback. And that callback is then given to the task of T through some new protocol. It's called the awaiter protocol. By means of a getAwaiter method call and an onCompleted method call. So basically, the code gets again teased apart. We say, like, this is something that happens before the first await, after the second await. We just construct those building blocks, and then we basically give all those building blocks to continuations. You had a question?
Yes. What is the difference between this and var x
as t.result? Var x equals t.result. Okay. If you do var x equals t dot result, as the gentleman is saying over here, right?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. It will wait for the result, but it will burn the current thread on doing so. So if you do x dot result here, you're blocked that entire operating system thread till the result comes back. If you do a wait, basically that thread can do something else, because in a lot of cases, asynchrony doesn't mean that you need to have multiple threads. Asynchrony can happen because you might have an asynchronous I/O operation waiting on the network, and at some point the operating system will be woken up and will spawn a little worker thread from the pool to say, like, this is the code to execute upon completion. So if you would basically do something like t.result on the UI thread, you would block the entire UI thread. If you would do an await, all that code beyond the await of t will execute in the future, being dispatched again to the UI thread. So you... Basically, what happens is, like, if you would step through this code, let's actually step through this code, this will be beautiful. Await.demo1. Await.demo1. right? If I do this, well, it's not a long-running operation, so it's not really fun. It's not fun at all. Let's make it long-running. Fingers crossed. Thread.sleep of 10,000. Good. It's long-running now. If I execute this code synchronously, and I do have 10, I'm blocked for 10 seconds. Right? So now we're waiting. The operating system thread is just sitting there waiting for the sleep to complete, and then we get the value. So there we go. If I do an await here, await of t, what actually will happen, and I will have to pump something somewhere, because this is ultimately going to my main thread, and that will quit prematurely. So it's not the best demo, but I will just show what happens when I do F10 on the await. I hit this code, I do an await, I do an F10. Oops, I'm back in the main method, and the main method continues executing. And now all that code that happens after the sleep completes will actually execute at some point. I could try to visualize that. It might not work, so don't give me bad points because of that. Windows.threads. Let's try to find the main thread and freeze it. And then I can press F5 without killing my process. If I press F5 now, oh, there we go. Console write line is happening on somewhere. It should be one of those. Here it is. The console write line happened after 10 seconds on a worker thread in the background. But my main thread could move on with its life in the meantime.
So it started mm-hmm. on the main thread.
Yep.
And then it said await, and then the main thread got mm-hmm. some other stuff, and then some other thread continued with the method.
Yes. So the question was like, the main thread starts the operation, returns prematurely, and then some other thread continues doing the work. That's indeed the case. You know, it depends, like, you know, on the thing you await. Some of the awaitable objects will actually do some synchronization context of post to come back to the original thread. So if you would execute this thing on the UI thread, it would actually do a post message to the UI thread, so you come back on the UI thread magically. And that happens through the message loop of the UI. But so in general, like if you would do an await on a network socket, today it's already the case if you do like begin read, end read, the begin read will happen on the main thread, and the end read will happen on the thread pool, where, you know, the callback comes back at some point in the future. So that's basically what's going on here. There are lots of posts on the await code being generated by the C# compiler team, so you can actually find more info there. If you want to leave, you can. I have some other questions, and I will stay here till they're all answered. Can an async method return something else than void? Yes, absolutely it can. An async method can return task, task of t, or void. Okay? Other questions? No. Oops.